Welcome to the Princeton Laxcast. I'm Jerry Price. I'm here with head coach Matt Madelon. Coach, welcome.
Glad to be back.
So the Tigers, since we last spoke, have won two games, defeating Stony Brook and Siena, and now head into the three Ivy game, three-week gauntlet of Dartmouth, Harvard, Cornell, still looking to get into the Ivy League tournament. It's an uphill climb, but it's still doable. But before we get into any of the lacrosse pieces, I thought we could start today with this weekend is Military Appreciation Day, and bringing back a lot of Tiger alums who've served in the military. And when you look at the number of military members who come out of this program, I think there's a perception that everybody who goes and plays lacrosse at Princeton goes immediately from Princeton to Wall Street to multi-million dollar jobs. But there's a lot of service-oriented kids who come through this program who have spent time in the military or in the military now doing all kinds of incredible things. And I think that's a very big plus for Princeton lacrosse.
It's a great plus for us. I mean, it's we're really looking forward to this weekend. We're really looking forward to honoring our military alums. And I think it's going to be eye-opening for our current roster. I think that we've got a handful of young guys on our team that have expressed interest in, you know, pursuing, you know, whether, you know, they have the opportunity to become a Navy SEAL or an Army Ranger, or just hearing more about it. And we're actually hearing that a lot more in the recruiting process as well. So really excited for this weekend, really proud of our alums, really impressed with the turnout and the support, you know, we're getting back from our alumni group. We're really looking forward to it.
I was surprised. I didn't realize some of those guys were in the military and had done like the kinds of things you talked about, being SEALs and Rangers and all that kind of thing, when they actually set out to go into the military. And I think it's great because I think that the stereotype does exist of not just Princeton, but the Ivy League lacrosse player or all lacrosse players. They go play lacrosse and then they go work on Wall Street. And I think that there's so many kids doing, or not kids, adults, men, who've come through this program who are doing so many different kinds of things. And you know, not everybody has gone down that same career path.
No, and I'm not sure of the statistics, but there are a lot of lacrosse players succeeding at high levels in the armed forces, you know, and whether it's the, you know, the athletic ability, you know, the mental fortitude, or just the different way to prepare and, you know, work within a team and develop leadership, you know, I think it transfers well.
And also, even beyond just the military part, there's so many guys that when there's like a big friends group event or some sort of like alumni gathering and you talk to these guys and you hear what they're doing, they go in a lot of different directions. And I think, you know, it's a real plus for the university and for the program that these guys come here and they aren't just all focused on one area. And that they do, and even the guys who do work on Wall Street and do all those things, they're also very service-oriented guys, and maybe they're not in the armed forces, but every one of these guys, they all talk about all the things they do in their communities, all the time that they give back, the ways they help people, and even you know, just coaching youth lacrosse or, you know, coaching lacrosse in cities or trying to grow the game someplace or doing other kinds of community-oriented things is a big thing for Princeton and for the alumni group.
It's a testament to our athletic department, our university, and you know, the gratitude that, you know, our alums show back to the university, and like you had said, in their communities. It's just the way they're groomed here. So we're really proud, and, you know, we actually started this week off with, you know, a little mentorship meeting, you know, earlier in the week, and we're looking forward to kind of capping that off this weekend, you know, when our current roster meets with some alums after our Sunday game. Saturday game.
So it's a doubleheader Saturday. It's Princeton-Dartmouth at noon and Princeton women against Yale at 3. Let's talk about the two games that Princeton has played in the last week, the Stony Brook game and then the Siena game. 16-8 win over Stony Brook, 17-11 over Siena. That was 15-4 at one point. What do you take away from either of those two games, if anything?
Sure. I mean, our goal coming out of, you know, our three Ivy losses were to continue to get better, shore up some of our systems, and give us an opportunity to make a run at the Ivy League tournament. So we took the opportunity over these last two games just to really work on some systems, clean up some in between the line stuff, and then kind of set our approach in motion for these next 3 weeks. So happy, still making a few mistakes, but happy with the outcome.
So let's talk about some specific guys, and let's start with Austin Sims and Riley Thompson. Austin Sims with 96 career points and Riley Thompson with 94 career points. So two senior middies. Riley's played a lot of attack, but two seniors who program veterans who are chasing 100 career points, which would be a great milestone. 34 players in school history have done it. The most recent is Michael Sowers. So, you know, last year it was Gavin McBride and Zach Currier who got there. So for Sims and Thompson to chase that number down would be a great thing.
Sure. I mean, you know, I know that, you know, when it boils down to it, those guys want to play as deep into May as possible. I think that any accolades that come across, you know, come along with that, and any milestones they reach would be wonderful. Those guys have had outstanding careers up to this point. We're hoping they finish really strong.
Are you aware of Austin Sims' numbers from his freshman and sophomore years?
So he not had, off the top of my head.
So he was mostly a defensive midi his freshman year. He had no goals as a freshman. Guy McBride had no goals either as a freshman. He had no goals as a freshman and then two assists. So he starts out with 2 points after 1 year. And then the next year he only had two assists. I think he had 23 goals and two assists as a sophomore. So he obviously started to be a goal scorer. But you look at that, he had four assists for his first 2 years. He had three assists in the game against Siena. So, and he would have had a fourth assist. He had a good look to, I think it was Brown who was open on the backside, and one of the poles just got his stick on it. But developing, I think he has, of his 96 points, I think now that would make 33 of them assists. So he's certainly developed into much more of a passer.
Sure. I mean, Austin's lacrosse IQ is excellent. He might not get enough credit for it, but he understands conceptually offense and defense very well. And when he's out there, he's able to make the reads on the fly, and he's athletic enough to do it under pressure. So he's really grown up over the last two seasons, and he's always impressed our coaching staff with his vision. So it's nice to see him getting rewarded there.
And then Riley Thompson, going back to Austin for a second, have three assists in one game after having four your first 2 years is pretty impressive. But and then Riley Thompson, he's always been what he is, which is a very consistent, very reliable scorer who, at the end of the game, your eyes notice other guys that he's played with his whole career, but then you look and you see he has his two goals and an assist, or three assists, or a goal and two assists, or just very consistent and just very, and he's also very, very good in something that's not measurable, which is knowing the offense and keeping things going.
Yeah, I mean, he's a special one. He, I've said it before in interviews and podcasts, he's like a mini offensive coordinator on the field. I think, where Riley is so impressive is exactly how you explained it. He's kind of your quiet assassin in the sense of he just kind of moves around fluently in the offense, makes great passes, creates great space for other Dodgers, never really steals possessions from anyone else. And he's played alongside some pretty big names. He holds his own consistently, and we're happy to have the guy.
And then let's talk about the game against Siena and the seven goals that Philip Robertson scored. That is a lot of goals. What I didn't realize, and I thought, he did the seven goals in eight shots. I thought he must have taken more than eight shots, but it's typical yeah. of him. Seven goals, eight shots.
I think he wants that eighth one back. I think
bounced it over to the
top. Yeah,
I
think it was either a good doorstep save. So he's done a really nice job within the framework of our offense of finding those seams, playing off Michael Sowers, finding different opportunities. But it's funny when it comes down to it, as good as Michael is and he's making these feeds and he's making these plays, you have to give guys like Gavin McBride and Phil Robertson a lot of credit. Just because they put themselves in the right spot doesn't mean the ball is going in the back of the net. You still have to make the play. And those were guys that, at times Michael gets the credit for that, but those are guys that are doing their job and doing an excellent job at that. So, Michael's wonderful. He's doing a good job patiently feeding in there, putting it right on the ear. But these guys are capitalizing. We're really happy. Phil does it all day, every day for us. Seven's a lot, but we weren't surprised.
Seven is a lot, especially when you only took eight shots. But the thing about – so, when you watch the game, at least from my perspective, you're watching Sowers. Your eyes are on Sowers. And, that's natural. You're drawn to the guy with the ball, and especially when it's him. But want to try to, focus a little bit on the guys off the ball and just see how they move without the ball to get themselves in that position. Because when you're in that position right on the doorstep and you're open, Sowers will get you the ball every time. But you have to get yourself into that position and you have to catch the ball and you have to shoot the ball. And, I think you're right. You sort of take it for granted that, Gavin McBride, he scored 54 goals because he was playing next to Michael Sowers. But then he goes into Major League Lacrosse and scores three goals in his first game. And then you look at Robertson, and I think it's interesting to me because if I'm focused on Sowers, the defense is focused on Sowers. Your eyes are just drawn to the guy. And then you have guys like Robertson and Riley Thompson and Dawson McKenzie who score a lot of goals close to the goal, who are very good at moving without the ball and getting open. And what's the challenge to that?
It's a true skill. We try to recruit it. We try to recruit guys that are strong with the ball and also very strong without the ball. If you if you're the best player on any team, you know, I don't know the true percentages, but, you know, if you're the best player on our offense, you're only holding the ball for maybe 10 or 15% of the time. So if you're a,
you know, not on your offense.
Well, you know, but even that, you know, as long as Michael holds it for it, it is still within ball movement. But when it comes down to it, you have to be a great complementary player. You have to be great at creating space for other Dodgers. You have to be great at putting pressure on slide packages without the ball. So we harp on it a lot. Coach March does a nice job of teaching those guys, you know, how to read the defenses and really put pressure on them. And Phil Robb's done an excellent job at that.
Do you think it's a benefit in that case to be small? Like Robertson's not tall. Do you think it's like you can get yourself lost a little bit inside there and you know, the defense, if you're 6'6", and, you know, they know where you are if you're, you know, are.
You know, maybe. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, when I first went into the MLL, you know, there was a guy, Terry Reardon, playing out in L.A., and he was this giant
played at Hopkins.
Guy. He played at Hopkins. He was a giant crease guy. You know, he's 6'4", 6'5", 6'6", and they would just – it was almost like they would alley-oop him the ball. They would just throw it up into the high crease, take the top off the defense, and he would be able to spike it. You know, most of the other off-ball guys throughout college lacrosse have never been one size or the other, too big, too small. You know, so I think it could be an advantage. Maybe you could slick someone, you know, be a little slippery on the crease, kind of go under the radar, smaller target, you know, smaller butt. So just really happy with his production. He's doing a really nice job.
Yeah, and Michael Sowers, we could talk about him all day. He went, you know, he has 144 points now. He went past Josh Sims. I don't know how much you know about Josh Sims.
No, a lot.
I mean, you know, he's in his sophomore year past Josh Sims. Now, I know Josh Sims is a middie, but he's a three-time first-team All-America middie who is among the best scoring middies in the history of college lacrosse. And, you know, Sowers, every time he moves up on the list and you look and see who he just passed, and it's another great player that he's moved past already in his sophomore year. But, you know, we've talked a lot about Michael's vision, but he's also not frantic. He's the most patient player I've ever seen. I mean, that's part of his strength.
His poise, it comes from his development and his work and focus on the fundamentals. I mean, his footwork's outstanding. It allows him to free up his hands to make these feeds. His ball protection's outstanding. His understanding of dodging angles and defensive angles and approach angles and understanding of defenses and how and when they slide to him really allow him to keep his poise and make those high-level feeds. It's really impressive for a young guy. Really impressive.
So the challenge on Saturday is Dartmouth. The last 2 years, Dartmouth has outscored Princeton 8-3 in the first half and been outscored 20-1 in the second half. So 2 years ago on Sherrod Field, it was 3-0 at halftime in favor of Dartmouth and then 7-3 Princeton final. And then last year it was 5-3 Dartmouth at halftime, 16-6 Princeton final. Is there any... I mean, to me, that's coincidence. It's not something that, like, is indicative of, you know, it's not statistically significant at this point, but... you know, you were the head coach for both of those games. What was the turnaround from the first half to the second half?
Really, I mean, it's our process over outcome. It's continue to stay the course, run our systems. We just need to start a little better. You know, we in both those games, looking back on it, we made a handful of mistakes in the first quarter, which swayed the possession battle, which caused, you know, a Dartmouth team to be able to capitalize and take advantage of their opportunities. I think that we need to be a little more disciplined in the first quarter of the game, in the first handful of possessions. We need to be buttoned up defensively. We need to make sure, you know, we're executing our game plan offensively. I think that, you know, that'll be able to sway the first quarter and be able to get us off and running there. But Dartmouth, Coach Callahan's done a great job. He's done a good job getting this program better each year. They've played a lot of one-goal games this year. They've been up on some very good teams. So, you know, we expect a great game.
And I also think that, you know, both teams are in the same situation. 0-3 in the league, where 3-3 could very likely get you into the Ivy League tournament, and the winner is going to be 1-3, so they're going to be one-third of the way there. And the interesting part is Princeton has Harvard Cornell, Dartmouth has Penn Brown. To get into the Ivy League tournament, you need to, you know, Princeton doesn't have the tiebreaker with Penn and Brown, but would have the tiebreaker with Harvard and Cornell if it were to win out. Dartmouth doesn't have the tiebreaker with Harvard and Cornell, but would have the tiebreaker with Penn and Brown if it won out. So you sort of polar opposites, but you're both trying to do the same exact thing, which is use this game as a springboard to try to get your way back into the Ivy League tournament. And, you know, I think when teams look big, I think I spend a lot of time looking big picture because it interests me, but I think when teams do that, they lose focus of where they are and how do you reel your team in and make sure they are aware. And same thing, same challenge for Dartmouth, that you got to execute first possession, second possession, and not worry about any of the big picture stuff.
Sure. I think our guys are aware of the big picture, but it is not a focus in our locker room. You know, that's something we've preached all year. You know, the next game's the most important one, and that's where our focus is right now. You know, we were able to come back from our bus trip from Albany, New York, get focused, and hopefully put a couple good practices together.
So it's Princeton and Dartmouth at noon on Saturday. That's a doubleheader with the women who play Yale at 3 o'clock. We'll be back next week to talk about that game and then to look ahead to the Harvard game, which is going to be in Cambridge the following Saturday. Coach Madelon, thanks for being with us. Good luck this weekend.
Thank you very much.
And for Coach Madelon, Jerry Price, thanking you for being with us here on the Princeton Laxcast each week. And we thank you once again for your support of Princeton men's lacrosse. And we look forward to seeing everybody out there on Saturday to recognize Princeton's military lacrosse alums.